Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the president on the VA's scandal, establishment wins in GOP primaries, China and Russia make a deal on energy. At the White House, the president called for VA accountability.
If these allegations prove to be true, it is dishonorable, it is disgraceful, and I will not tolerate it, period.
Mitch McConnell beat back a Tea Party challenger in Kentucky and set his sights on a Republican Senate majority.
We can take the reins of power away from Harry Reid and make this president accountable.
And Vladimir Putin signs a $400 billion natural gas deal in China. Here's Chinese leader Xi Jinping.
We attach great importance to the quality of practical cooperation between China and Russia. We will begin cooperating on more large-scale strategic projects to improve our two nations' power and international competitiveness.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with political junkie Ken Rudin, Brian Monroe of CNN, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining us this week from Washington is Ken Rudin, former NPR political editor. He now hosts the weekly Political Junkie podcast. Ken Rudin, welcome to On Point. It's terrific to have you.
I'm excited to be here, Tom. Thanks a lot.
We've missed your voice. It's great to hear it right here, Ken. Great to have
you. Well, I'm going to keep talking for the full hour.
Okay, that's just fine by us. Also with us from Washington, Brian Monroe, Washington editor of opinion and commentary for CNN. Brian, thanks for joining us. Great. Welcome back to On Point.
It's always great to be here with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ken, and Brian.
Can we jump right into these primary results? We've got you here, Ken Rudin. We want to get your view on this. We've got what have been described as mainstream or establishment or institutional. You tell us. Republican wins over Tea Party folks. Here's a kind of a Tea Party voice. President and CEO of FreedomWorks, a Tea Party alliance, is Matt Kibbe. He was talking with Jeremy Hobson on NPR's Here and Now on Wednesday. He said the primaries were not a failure for the Tea Party because they'd pulled a lot of candidates to more conservative positions by challenging them.
We're trying to change the makeup of the Republican Party, how they run, and more importantly, how they'll govern should they win the Senate majority. We did have some victories last night in House seats like Barry Loudermilk in Georgia's 11th District. But we also lost our fight against Mitch McConnell. And I think that the outcome of that is a Mitch McConnell that rediscovered his conservatism in the process of defending his seat.
And here, Ken, Brian, Jack, here's John Boehner, House Speaker, saying difference between GOP and Tea Party. What difference?
I'm not going to enter into this distinction between the Tea Party and Republicans, because it's a distinction you're going to have a hard time finding.
All right. Ken Rudin, what happened in these Republican primaries this week? How do you read it?
Well, I think the Republican folks who were targeted, mostly Mitch McConnell, they learned from what happened in 2010 and 2012. And that is that the Tea Party caught them unawares in those two cycles. They put up candidates like Richard Murdoch in Indiana, Todd Akin in Missouri, Sharon Engel, Christine, I'm Not a Witch, O'Donnell. And I think the Republican establishment, whatever that means, was caught flat-footed. So Mitch McConnell knew he was going to be targeted early. He raised a ton of money. He stepped up his opposition research campaign, and he swamped Matt Bevin. Was Matt Bevin the perfect candidate? No. But the point is that they were not going to be caught sleeping as they were in the previous two cycles.
Look on across the board, Ken. What did you see in other primaries, and what do you see coming still in Mississippi?
Well, Mississippi is one to watch, and we'll talk about that in a second. But, of course, there were a lot of, again, good news for the Republican establishment. You know, Jeb Bush keeps talking about we'd rather win than be ideologically pure. And that's what Republicans around the country said. In Georgia, the two Tea Party congressmen finished fourth and fifth in that primary. In Idaho, Mike Simpson was a longtime Tea Party target. He's a member of the House from the 2nd District who won overwhelmingly. In Oregon, a more moderate Republican woman won the Senate nomination there. The only thing that surprises me, the only thing I'm disappointed at, is that I read somewhere that in Oregon they have male-only voting. And I think that women should have the right to vote in every state, including
U.S. Postal Service is right there with you. Brian Monroe, what do you see here? Is this a kind of swan song for the Tea Party, or is it fully incorporated into what Ken's there calling the Republican establishment now?
Well, you know, we had a conversation this week on CNN about, is this, with McConnell's win and a few others, is this the grown-ups in the GOP back in charge? Have they stepped back and reclaimed the party? Or have, in fact, the Tea Party have successfully, they've won. They've pulled the Republican Party so far to the right that, as John Boehner said, there is no daylight between the establishment Republicans and the Tea Party. Was it a process to sort of co-opt the far right and bring them in, or did the whole party shift so far to the right that there's really no difference anymore?
So what's the answer? What's the answer, oh guru?
Oh, well, I think it's a little bit of the latter, that the Republican Party, you look at somebody like President Ronald Reagan. Would he have survived in today's Republican Party? Probably not, with the exception of what Jeb Bush said. Reagan was a winner. And the Republicans desperately, desperately want to win. And they'll do whatever they need to do to adjust the party so that they can put together a winning team. And if that means shifting far to the right to appease the Tea Party wing, so be it.
And yet, Jack Beatty, it's hard to see this as a distinction without a difference when you look at how much energy and money establishment Republicans put into getting the whip hand back here, getting the steering wheel back.
Yes, I mean, it was a big push. Karl Rove has been dedicated to it. Mitch McConnell said, "I think we are going to crush them everywhere, and with lots of money they have, that is the establishment." And no, perhaps there isn't a great difference on issues, but the optics are different. The kind of candidate, for example, in Georgia, one of the nominees for Senate, Jack Kingston, is a relatively soft-spoken fellow. He's against, he doesn't believe in evolution, but he's not Paul Bruhn, his Tea Party challenger, who said evolution is from the pit of hell, a lie from the pit of hell. Mm. Well, the optics are a little better there. But the kind of problem the GOP runs into, what looks good for them in 2014, what Mr. Boehner says, there's not much daylight, we're united, we're all conservative, is also a problem for 2016. Bill McInturff, the Republican pollster this week, said, we're a party with two wings, a congressional wing doing very well, and a presidential wing. How's that doing? Well, he says, looking ahead, prediction pain. And you have, Tom Mann at the Brookings Institute saying the Republicans simply aren't a presidential party anymore. One reason, because they're doing so well in such white, to be blunt about it, districts all over the country that they don't feel they have to make accommodations on immigration, on global warming, on gay marriage, on other things. And the general electorate and the Republican Party, there's a gap between them.
Make no mistake. Yes, Brian, please.
I was going to say, make no mistake, the Republicans want the White House. They want it bad. But their strategy right now appears to be as simple as go through their list of Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, their front runners, but really just hope that Hillary Clinton doesn't run. And so they're doing everything they can. You heard Karl Rove talk about Hillary's
health of her brain. And then there's Benghazi, all these. Mm-hmm.
The Benghazi. And they're trying to so hard to persuade her, to force her, to cajole her not to run. That seems to be the core of their strategy right now. I don't know if that's a winning strategy.
Ken Rudin, look a little closer to this date with us. At the Senate contest this fall, the Republicans would like to take the majority there. We heard Mitch McConnell say that at the top of our hour. He would be in charge, not Harry Reid. How do these primary results, what do they bode for the midterms and Senate control, Ken?
Well, certainly what we saw on Tuesday and a few weeks ago in North Carolina, where the so-called establishment candidate there, Tom Tillis, won without a runoff against a Tea Party opponent, their stronger candidates are winning. Clearly, Mitch McConnell is stronger in Kentucky than Matt Bevin would have been. Clearly, the two Republicans who made it into the runoff in Georgia are far stronger than the losing Tea Party folks. The woman who won in Oregon and a very blue state is stronger than the conservative she defeated. So ultimately, they do have a good shot. And the good news for the Republicans is that, of course, we all know that they need a net gain of 6 seats to win control of the Senate. But these 6 states, and most of these states that are being mostly competitive, are states that Mitt Romney won in 2012, the red states, the South Dakotas, the West Virginias, the Louisianas, Alaska, Arkansas, states, North Carolina, states like that. So the Republicans feel they have the momentum. They know that President Obama's poll numbers are not improving. And when you add the VA scandal and Benghazi and whatever else they want to just excite their base, they feel good. But they do have to worry about states like Georgia and Kentucky when they have fairly good we think, strong Democratic candidates. We don't know if the demographics are changing enough for in Georgia to help the Democrats. But, you know, it's not a done deal. And for all the people who are convinced that Mitch McConnell will be the next majority leader, it's only May. We still have many months to go.
Here's one who would say he will not, I guess. Kentucky Secretary of State Alison Lundgren Grimes. She won the Democratic primary in Kentucky on Tuesday. She'll challenge Senator Mitch McConnell. In her victory speech, she pushed back hard against his criticisms, saying she's no rubber stamp for the president.
Mitch McConnell would have you believe that President Obama is on Kentucky's 2014 election ballot. We all know that Senator McConnell has been in Washington a little bit too long.
Brian Monroe, what about Mitch McConnell's own seat there in the challenge from Grimes?
Well, you know, he is not as safe as he would hope to be. Yeah, you know, it is a seat that has, you know, certainly gone Republican, but Grimes is no slouch. You know, but McConnell has a legacy in the Senate that he has to worry about, that he has been the leader of a lot of folks who have, you know, really entrenched themselves and been the party of no in the filibusters and even in the more, you know, sedate Senate. The Republicans have stopped a lot of things from happening. But he's got to explain that.
He took it running away in the primary this week. Brian Monroe with CNN. Please stand by in Washington. Great to have you here. Ken Rudin, wonderful to have you as well. Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast is out there, but he's with us today. Jack Beatty, this is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Primary votes, VA scandal. The Department of Justice goes after China. The House pushes back a little on the NSA. And, of course, the story of Iran's happy dancers. Six young Iranians arrested on Tuesday for posting a video on YouTube of themselves, the women without their hair covered, dancing to the Pharrell Williams song, Happy. Most of them out now. I think the videographer may still be in jail. The Iranian leader, Hassan Rouhani, tweeting, let's not be too hard on happiness. Culture, really interesting culture tension there in Iran. Ken Rudin is with us this hour, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, joins us from Washington, former NPR political editor. Brian Monroe is here, Washington editor of opinion and commentary for CNN. Jack Beatty is here, and let's get a call from Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell was celebrating this week. Chris in Bowling Green. Chris, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
Okay. What do you see?
Well, first of all, I want to say that the only Tea Party candidate that could have beaten Mitch McConnell is already in the U.S., and that's Rand Paul. Mitch McConnell is a very established person in the state. He's not going to go anywhere soon. My other point that I want to make is this. The Tea Party of today is to the Republican Party what the Christian right was to the Republican Party back in the 80s and 90s.
Meaning what? They're an extra power pack, or they're a positive or negative to you, Chris?
The Tea Party is pulling the GOP to the right, whereas, you know, if otherwise the GOP would tend to moderate itself and be more in line with, I guess, mainstream America.
Is that a good thing? Is that a good thing by your lights or not, Chris?
Well, I'll be honest with you, Tom. I was on the primary campaign staff with Rand Paul. I was a photographer, and I don't like the Christian right personally because of the fact that they enforce morality on people. I like the libertarian view of the Tea Party.
Yep.
And I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, but I'm just saying it's an observation of what the reality of it is.
That's a very interesting Tea Party to the GOP, what the Christian right was some years ago. Of course, that movement lost some visibility lately. Tea Party, who knows where they're headed? In, out, up, down? Chris, let me hold that for a minute. Michael in Haverhill, Massachusetts, another voice here. Michael, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think the Tea Party is not dead. I think they've done a great job of embedding themselves in the Republican Party. The mainstream Republicans, the big wealth, and I refer to the Romneys and McConnells, the big money guys in the Republican Party, are simply using these little dogs in the Tea Party. They're the little pups that scream the loudest, cause the most trouble for the country, and, you know, they're the Sarah Palins of the world.
They're not all Sarah Palin, and they are your fellow citizens. I mean, you know, there was...
Well, I'm not so sure if I want to be associated with them as fellow citizens, the way they act about this country. They want to, most of them want to put us on a Bible foothold. They're anti-intellectual. They don't want anything to do with science. They eschew anything that says the word evolution. They go into apoplectic fits. I just think the mainstream people don't give a darn about them and are just using them, playing to their anger and the anger over unemployment, lack of jobs,
yep.
constant war that never stops.
Reasonable to be upset about those things. Michael, I appreciate your perspective as well. Ken Rudin, what about our first caller there from Kentucky's point saying, well, this is to the GOP, the Tea Party is as the Christian right was. What do you make of that analogy, Ken?
Well, Chris made a lot of points. Let me just go through them quickly. First of all, we cannot underestimate the role that Rand Paul played in backing Mitch McConnell. He basically neutered any kind of Tea Party opposition to McConnell. Mm-hmm. It was a big, big plus for McConnell. The big difference I see between the Tea Party's role of today and the Christian right's influence in the Republican Party, say with the Reagan in 1980, was the Christian right, yes, they tried to make the Republican Party much more conservative, and they did so in many, many ways, but they did not go after fellow Republicans. They're really, their ire, their object of disdain were the Democrats. And the Tea Party, aside from what they did in 2010 by electing John Boehner Speaker, clearly, but for the last couple of cycles, their attacks have mostly been on these so-called Republican rhinos. That's the real big difference. Back then, the Christian rights were going after the Democrats. Now the Tea Party seems to be going after more Republicans than Democrats.
Enforcing ideological purity. And, of course, our caller Michael says a plague on both. I want to turn to the VA scandal. We've got a lot to look at in this hour. It has been mounting and mounting. Former General Eric Shinseki, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, really in the hot seat. And this week, the president talking about it. Here was President Obama at the White House with Eric Shinseki.
But we have to let the investigators do their job and get to the bottom of what happened. Our veterans deserve to know the facts. Their families deserve to know the facts. Once we know the facts, I assure you, if there is misconduct, it will be punished.
Were they put on secret waiting lists? Were they shunted off to wait and wait and maybe die on those waiting lists? Republicans and some Democrats. A Republican right here from South Dakota, Senator John Thune, quick to jump on, slamming the administration's response and the president in particular.
This VA issue is a national embarrassment, and the president's response to it is an embarrassment.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in this still unfolding scandal around the VA and the president's this week response?
Well, one face of the president's response, I think, was caught by a headline in the Washington Post. Obama is president passive over the Veterans Affairs scandal. Now, it was above a column by Dana Milbank, who's not really an ally of the president's. But it caught something, I think, nevertheless. And that something is what seems to be lacking in Mr. Obama lately, and that is energy, oomph. You know, Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 70 says, energy in the executive is a leading character in the definition of good government. What does that look like in the executive? Well, I've mentioned this before, but here's what it looks like. Harold Howe, LBJ's Commissioner of Education, says that after at night, sometimes past 11 o'clock, President Johnson would call him up and say, how many schools did you integrate today?
Wow. That's on the case.
That's energy in the executive. Now, this scandal, or the rudiments of it, the intimations of it, been around almost 6 months. Has the president been getting ahead of it? Have people on his team seen the danger this could lead to? I mean, leave out the human issue. Could they have seen the political damage that it could do? There doesn't seem to be much sign of that. And, you know, it isn't just on domestic policy. It's also on foreign policy where, you know, one of the president's staunchest allies, the New York Times editorial page, said it does not feel as if he is exercising sufficient American leadership and power, even if he is in fact working to solve a problem. And then you have the president's own sort of diminished, what the Times calls sadly pinched view of the powers of his office. He said in the Philippines about places like Syria, Egypt, Israel, you hit singles, you hit doubles. Every once in a while, you may be able to hit a home run, to which the Times said, you don't inspire a team to go out and bloop a single over an infielder. There does seem to be a kind of residue resignation the president has, a kind of capitulation to the given that is, it seems to me, to be a malaise of this administration.
Wow. Jack Beatty goes big on the president. Brian Monroe, how about it? We see President Obama traveling. We see him talking. But has he checked out somehow? Has he resigned to small ball?
That's something that we're seeing, you know, his reaction to this has been surprising. You know, remember, CNN was the one that broke the story 6 months ago.
Yes, we talked with your reporter out of Phoenix on the VA hospital
Drew
there.
Griffin and
had him right here
Patricia
on the
air. DiCarlo.
Yep.
You know, Drew has been on this and really, and so it was surprising. Was it last week when our Jim Acosta asked the president, so, you know, when was the first time you heard about this issue? And Jay Carney said he learned about it through our reporting. And that's surprising because, you know, you've got Shinseki and the entire VA infrastructure who were not aware that there were at least allegations of not, in some cases we proved them, where there were these secret lists and there were, you know, up to 40 people who died, veterans. You know, my father's a veteran. He's a two-star general.
Yeah.
And, you know, the folks who have fought and injured themselves or gotten injured overseas through our wars are not being able to get the care. They have to wait weeks, months in some cases for care. And 40 of them allegedly died while waiting. They didn't know about that until we reported that. That's kind of shameful. And so when he came out at his news conference this week and said, you know, he's angry, he's serious, this is of great personal concern to him, it felt a little, you know, too little, too late.
And we got a big critique on the table here. I want to bring it to you, Ken Rudin, a couple callers first who get the VA scandal right in the middle of it. At the moment, Jeffrey in Boston, you're on the air.
Tom, hello. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great.
Thank you for having me on.
You bet.
I'm a veteran. I'm a captain in the Army, have served two combat tours, and I feel like the commentators are missing the bigger picture, as most of the media is.
Okay.
Because, you know, the VA does what it does based upon the budget that Congress allocates. And Congress being up in arms and the media going after the president is missing the fact that the VA does what it does based upon the money that it's given.
But Jeffrey, we've had big politicians on here, even Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on here, not really complaining about the money, saying that we're just not executing.
I know, I get that, but you know, they're shifting focus, right? So if a VA had more money, it would have more doctors and it would have more nurses, and then the wait times wouldn't be what they are. That's just simple economics and facts. I mean, you can go after what the president's speech was or how he reacted, and that's small ball, frankly, because the bigger picture is we fought two wars, we have a lot of veterans that are struggling, and if they don't have, if the VA doesn't have money for doctors and nurses, the wait times are going to be long.
Jeffrey, let me get it right there. Brian Monroe, it's hypocrisy to attack this as a scandal because the funds weren't appropriated. What do you think about
it? Well, I think it's beyond funds. Yes, it is. You know, the president's reaction is one piece of the story, and the real story is that, you know, he campaigned on this when he first ran for president.
Yes,
he knew about this was an issue. This has been a systemic issue going back through several administrations that the VA has long wait times.
But isn't it still fair to look at execution?
It is. And in fact, you know, Representative Jeff Miller, who heads he's a Republican in charge of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, made one comment that was really, President Obama could institute a fix today. And that is by signing an executive order that allows if you're waiting in line at the VA, for you to more quickly and more easily go to the private sector to get your care and have it being paid for versus waiting for VA doctors. And if not, the way it's supposed to work is right now is if you can't get into the VA, then you get to kicked over to the DOD, to military hospitals.
Yeah.
If they can't take you, then you get, you know, a chance to go.
We've heard Republican voices say that right here. Of course, the private sector for many Americans is no panacea necessarily either. Ken, I still want to bring you this big portrayal of the president. One more call first. On Alaska, Wisconsin, Craig is on. Hi, Craig.
Hello. I'm retired military. I find the VA situation to be terrible. It needs to be fixed, and I agree that there needs to be more providers. But the thing that irritates me the most in this whole situation is the Republican side, who voted time after time after time to repeal Obamacare. We've got American citizens dying every day, and there's no talk about those individuals. And I find that very frustrating. We need to fix the entire healthcare situation in this country so everyone has access to care.
Craig, we've got it. There's the hypocrisy charge again. Ken Rudin, how do you see the VA scandal? And then pull the curtains back to Jack Beatty's big critique of the president as lacking energy, somehow checked out, playing small ball as the country's got big challenges.
Well, as a longtime listener and first-time caller, I want to say that President Obama, it did sound very similar to what he said after the Affordable Care Act, that I'm mad as hell and I'm outraged. I'm going to get to the bottom of this. But unlike Obamacare or Benghazi, those scandals or so-called scandals you could point to as partisan wrangling, that the Republicans were looking for a Benghazi scandal when there may have not have been one, or the Affordable Care Act. But this one is real. One is, first of all, it's 6 months to the election, less than 6 months to the election, closer than the botched rollout of the ACA website. But it also, yes, it talks about accountability, but it also, you could see that it's not just a Republican attack thing. Democrats are very, very nervous. You know, we heard Alison Grimes earlier saying, well, ha-ha, why are you attacking Obama? Because he's not even on the ballot. That sounds like what Republicans did in 2006. Well, Bush isn't on the ballot, so why are you attacking him? Mm. But Alison Grimes is among those Democrats who said Shinseki has to be fired. Forget about...
She's distancing.
We shouldn't forget about what could be done, what should be done to help the funding of veterans' hospitals and things like that. But politically... And in politics, perception is reality. It's a serious, serious problem for the White House and the Democrats. And as I said, less than 6 months to go before the election.
Can go bigger, because Jack is saying that there's an underperformance here in the White House on a deeper level, not just on the VA scandal, but energy is the elemental measure of executive leadership. And this president isn't generating it at home or abroad.
Well, I mean, there's something to be said about that. You know, we talk about when the president's criticized about his foreign policy, he says, well, what do you want me to do? Invade Syria? What do you want me to do? Drop bombs in Crimea? I mean, obviously, that's not
you want a war.
Yep. I was going to say, but there is a passivity that seems to be, well, you know, we're going to do something. We got to do something. We got to do something about Syria. We really have to do something about understanding what happened in Benghazi. Really, the stuff in Crimea is really, really bad. But he sounds like he's an editorial writer or maybe some intellectual who's sitting back and saying, I wish something were done. I wish I could contact the president, but he is the president. Does it mean sending troops on the ground? Probably not. Does it mean, you know, some kind of like an overreaction? That's the fear. But the alternative, what we're seeing now, just seems to be extremely passive. And in that sense, I agree with Jack.
Oklahoma City, Kenneth is calling. Kenneth, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about how, you know, the VA is a bureaucracy that for the past 30 or 40 years has been run by people who really didn't believe that the government can solve problems. And in a lot of the regions where we're facing problems like this, we still have VA run by people whose ideology is that government can't solve problems.
But shouldn't the central government still be managing that, revving it up, setting it straight?
Sure, absolutely. And I would argue that President Obama's administration has done a lot. You know, since 2010, the VA has received every dime it's asked for in funding. So Congress as well has stepped up to the plate on this issue. We have a real problem still lingering from these eras of government can't solve problems, and anyone who's on the government's rolls is a moocher or somebody who's trying to take advantage of federal benefits.
Hey, Kenneth, our time is short before the break. Jack Beatty, how about it? It's an attitudinal problem toward government, or it's an execution problem on the ground, Jack, or both?
I don't know about this attitude. I don't know who does he mean in the bureaucracy. The people that have been running the VA, at least to my memory, haven't been anti-government people. They've been running a government healthcare system. And by the way, which is more popular once veterans get in it than any of the other forms of than Medicare, than private. People think better of it once
they're inside. Jack, hold the thought. Jack Beatty, Brian Monroe at CNN, Ken Rudin with Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Governor Mary Fallon of Oklahoma spoke at a ceremony marking the one-year anniversary of the massive EF5 tornado that killed 24, including 7 children in Moore, Oklahoma.
It's important that we do remember, that we reflect, that we not forget that there are still Oklahomans that are recovering, that are healing, that are suffering today.
On Tuesday, a big rig hauling an estimated 20 million bees crashed on I-95 in Newark, Delaware. There were bees all over the highway. Beekeeper David Feinberg.
They're giving us a half hour to get all the hives we can off the truck. There's millions of, literally millions of bees down there.
And Led Zeppelin sued for allegedly lifting the iconic opening riff in Stairway to Heaven from a song by the lesser-known band Spirit. Here's Led Zeppelin's 1971 Stairway to Heaven. And here's Spirit's 1968 Taurus. Boy, I don't know. We report, you decide. I think I'm calling my lawyer on that one. Ken Rudin is with us from Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, former NPR political editor. Brian Monroe is here from Washington, Washington editor of opinion and commentary at CNN. Jack Beatty's here. There was that remarkable moment this week when the U.S. Department of Justice came down with indictments of five Chinese military officers, hackers, they said, stealing American intellectual property, industrial espionage. Here was Attorney General Eric Holder.
When a foreign nation uses military or intelligence resources and tools against an American executive or corporation to obtain trade secrets or sensitive business information for the benefit of its state-owned companies, we must say enough is enough.
In Beijing, they were having none of it. Here's Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei denying the allegations, demanding the indictments be withdrawn, interpreted by CCTV.
We have never engaged or participated in the so-called cyber theft for trade secrets. It is the U.S. who has launched cyber surveillance and wiretapping against individuals, companies, and institutions for many countries around the world. China is a victim of this.
The NSA is the bad guy, says China. And then here comes Vladimir Putin making a big energy deal in Beijing. Brian Monroe, go first with us, if you would, to these indictments. I mean, nobody thinks we're going to see those Chinese military officers in handcuffs in the United States. So what's going on here?
No, there's not going to be any bringing them in. But what's really happening is the rules have changed. There's a new set of norms that the U.S. is trying to enforce globally about where's the line that you can cross on, or not cross, on corporate hacking versus state-sponsored cyber terrorism, or at least cyber espionage.
They tracked it down to Shanghai, and you've got these lines out into big American corporations with what looks like a lot of evidence of wholesale theft of intellectual property, valuable stuff.
Yeah, it is. And it you know, it has been going on for a while. And there was sort of, I wouldn't say a nod and a wink, but some of it was assumed you deal with it through back channels. But this was the first time, you know, that Attorney General Holder, you know, came out and said no, this far and no further. And that is clearly a redefinition. And it may come back to bite the U.S. because, you know, spying happens all the time. We all know that. But to what degree? And, you know, it's one thing to try to get into military secrets, another thing to get into corporate secrets. And some say for the Chinese, there's no distinction there. It's all part of what they do. But the U.S. has now said enough and no more.
Jack Beatty, China is saying, come on, you're making a distinction without a difference here, United States. You're going all over the world, surveilling everybody, doing espionage on everybody, and then you don't like it when we take some of your stuff. This is all about power. This is how we increase our power. You do it your way. A little mano a mano this week, Jack.
Yes, and all thanks to Edward Snowden. None of this would have been available. You know, people, it wouldn't have been as credible a charge were it not for Snowden. You know, the scope of the theft is breathtaking. I mean, Peter Singer, we've had him on our show at Brookings, he calls it the largest theft in human history, this intellectual property plundering. And he says it goes from things like the F-35, which is a $1 trillion investment we've made in a plane. The Chinese seem to be tracking that pretty well, right down to the design, to chair design, to furniture makers. It's that pervasive, and it's become a, you know, and it isn't random either. I mean,
Targeted.
Very targeted. And in fact, if you complain, I think there was Alcoa, the Steelworkers Union, other. If there's a complaint to the WTC or to
by an American company,
by an American company or to our even to our Commerce Department, the Chinese then target the complainer. I mean, they go right after. It's as if they're sending a message. You want to complain about doing business in China to the World Trade Organization? Well, let's see.
Jack, you remember when America was young and some famous names from this country went off to England and came back with designs for looms and more that upset our economy on a track. But China's big already. China's already a huge economy, and this thing still rolls on. And then here comes Vladimir Putin. He's in trouble with Europe over Ukraine and more, with the United States over that. He does an energy deal with China, 30 years, $400 billion, lots of gas here. Ken Rudin, does this deal with China relieve the pressure that the West is trying to put on Putin with its sanctions?
Well, I'm not sure how much pressure Putin was under anyway. Yes, we know about the sanctions. We know about everything the U.S. is trying to do to show its displeasure on the actions in Crimea and elsewhere in eastern Ukraine. But for all the financial problems that were supposed to affect Moscow, obviously, when you see the headlines of Putin and China coming up with this gazillion-dollar deal, I mean, you could see that Putin doesn't look like he's hurting in the bank at all for anything. And all the talk about sanctions and what kind of punitive financial things we could put on Russia just seem to be fall by the wayside. I don't see any. It looks like, if anything, Putin is winning again, and he's making more money. And we can have all the sanctions we want, but nothing is going to take effect.
Let's go to Jason in Buffalo, New York. Jason, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to see the importance of this gas deal. It wasn't the gas deal itself. It's actually the first time that a deal has been struck outside of the U.S. dollar. They're going to be using their ruble and the Chinese yuan in trade. And that's important because every other leader in the last, decade, Muammar Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, and Iran, who tried selling oil or gas outside of the dollar, the media, what's the phrase we use, we liberated them. So basically, we get free credit around the world. I'm a former Wall Street broker, so I know of what I speak. We get free credit around the world from bond buying because people need access to our dollars for oil and gas purchases. And the BRIC nations have assigned 80 other nations to begin trading next year outside of the dollar. So I think that we're looking at a big problem of our debt notes coming back home to roost and a big dollar devaluation over next year.
That is interesting. I had not focused on that, Jason. If that gets ahead of steam and the dollar in any degree falls out of absolute favor as the global currency, implications for our economy, Jason?
Absolutely huge. This is a very, very big deal. In fact, the rest of the world reported on this story as the de-dollarization meeting, so you could look it up on that. But the Western media only talks about the actual deal, specifics, a 30-year deal, $400 billion. But it is very, very important because Russia and China are very large bondholders.
Yeah.
China hasn't been buying bonds lately. In fact, what they've been doing is their maturing debt, they have been loaning out to both Europe and Africa and collateralizing it with gold.
And getting out of U.S. treasuries, you're saying?
Completely. In fact, Russia in March, dumped 20% of its U.S. Treasury holdings, and in which Belgium somehow came up with $30 billion to purchase in last month. So, I mean, there's definitely some funny things going on. They were not happy with our QE over the last, the last 8 years now. And because of that, they stopped buying the bonds, and they're beginning to reuse those assets for different power plays around the world.
Jason, you're great. Stay in touch with us. Best callers in the world right here at On Point. You want to know what's going on? We've got economists calling in. That's really terrific. It does make me think about Ukraine. They've got a big vote there on president this week. We've seen the images of Russian troops pulling back from the border, but nobody knows exactly. Brian Monroe, do you see the Ukraine crisis cooling? Are we past the peak of this thing? Has Putin got what he wants with Crimea? Trillions in gas, we're told, under the Black Sea adjacent to Crimea, and some federal sort of decentralization of Ukraine that gives him more clout there. Is that it? Is that enough?
Well, first, I've got to get a shout out to your guest, your caller, Jason. You have some of the smartest audience in radio.
You so got it, baby.
So
it's right here. Of course. No surprise.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. Vladimir Putin just came out and said in kind of his weakened voice, which you have to take with a grain of salt, that he actually is saying the sanctions have had some impact on him. He's pulling the troops back. He is now saying that he will recognize the legitimate president of Ukraine, and the election's coming up. And so he's, you know, he's trying to strike a different tone. But we know that, you know, he is a KGB tried and true, and that you have to be very careful what he says versus what he does.
A lot of,
And so, you know, is something shifting over there? I don't know. I just think he's right now consolidating his victories and looking for the next opportunity.
What may be shifting is who's got what kind of standing in the world. Interesting this week, Secretary of State John Kerry, it's commencement season. He gave a commencement address at Boston College on Monday. We heard him there arguing that the U.S. needs to remain engaged in world affairs and act as a leader internationally. The world's looking for that, he said.
In a shrinking world, we can't measure our success just by what we achieve as Americans for Americans, but also by the security and shared prosperity that we build with our partners all over the world. In times of crisis, violence, strife, epidemic, and instability, believe me, the world still looks to the United States of America as a partner of first resort. People aren't worried about our presence, they're worried about our leaving.
They're worried about our leaving. Jack, you think so?
Well, I think President Obama was elected on the "they're worried about our leaving and we're gonna go." And we're gonna go.
come home, America, and let's deal with our problems.
Right, and that message, after how many years, people perhaps started to listen to it, and it may, in some way, I don't myself believe this, but Republicans charge it. It emboldened people to, you know, our passive stand in foreign policy emboldened Putin, for example.
But Americans were tired too of what seemed like endless war, blood. Shed treasure spent.
Of course there were. And yet, on the other hand, you have a foreign policy that has yet to do anything. I mean, this week someone remarked, I think it was Roth Dothout, you know, if you have a one line for Obama's foreign policy, it would be, "I didn't start the war in Iraq." Well, that's a big thing, you know? That's a really big thing, and it's tremendously important. But what else? What other achievement? Now, perhaps Iran can turn things around if they can make a nuclear deal there. But what? But you know, isn't it interesting that Secretary Kerry's talking about, you know, our allies look to us? Well, as I was reading about the trip to Asia, you know, the pivot to Asia and the president's trip around there, the allies wanted reassurance. They were looking at Ukraine and the Middle East, and they were saying, "Hey, are you people going to keep your word to us?" So,
well, that is worrying about us leaving. I mean, that may be a confirmation of Kerry's point there in a way. If I may, Jack, here, listener online, JP writes, "I'd love it if you take a moment to discuss the confirmation of Judge David Barron to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. He's the person who wrote the memo permitting President Obama to extrajudicially kill noncombatant Americans overseas." That's exactly right. He did. Brian, what did you see in the hearings this week? His reception on Capitol Hill? Is he headed into this higher judgeship?
Well, you know, I think it is looking better, but it's still not clear. You know, one of the things, too, is, and this gets back to the Senate races, is that the confirmation process, you know, when they change the rules around the filibuster, you know, now you only need 51 to confirm in certain judicial positions. And so, you know, it the scrutiny of his record is slowing him down. But I don't know. I think it might go through.
We saw Rand Paul standing up loud and clear. This was on Wednesday. Kentucky's Rand Paul. He's come up a couple times in this hour arguing that nomination should not go forward. Or at least he said he's concerned about Barron's legal thinking on drones, Americans, extrajudicial killing.
I rise today to oppose the nomination of anyone who would argue that the president has the power to kill an American citizen not involved in combat and without a trial. I rise today to say that there is no legal precedent for killing American citizens not involved in combat, and that any nominee who rubber stamps and grants such power to a president is not worthy of being placed one step away from the Supreme Court.
Ken Rudin, if David Barron is indeed confirmed, are we one step closer to this being settled American policy law?
Well, probably not. I mean, we see more and more congressional action. We saw what happened in the House this week about trying to curb the NSA on phone surveillance and keeping of records. But it was interesting that if you looked at the votes, Barron got all the votes from Democrats. And it's interesting that the partisanship in Washington is just so severe that when you think of policies like surveillance and drones and the indiscriminate drone attacks in many cases, you would think it would be the Democrats, the left, who would be more outraged about this, and perhaps the left is outraged about it. But when you have Dianne Feinstein, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who's been basically a rubber stamp for the longest time on NSA surveillance, I mean, she's coming around a little bit, but you see Democrats who you would think on ideological reasons they would oppose a nominee like that, but because it's nominated by a Democratic president, so the Democrats are in line and the Republicans say no. If this was a Bush nominee, you'd probably see the opposite happening as well.
And the softest tap on the NSA surveillance this week in the House, we'll see where that goes. One more call, New Orleans. Sean, you're on the air. We just got a minute, Sean.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. This certainly doesn't compare to corporate international espionage or anything like that, but I just wanted to call in about the Led Zeppelin clip that you played. And, you know, the descending chromatic bass line is like one of the most universal tropes in music. And while the proximity of the two recordings in time is a little disturbing, I just think that, you know, Zeppelin adds an ascending melody on top with the descending tritone in the fourth measure. I think it's very much unique, and I'd be interested to see what a court would decide, but I'd be very surprised if they decided against Led Zeppelin.
How great is that? Does New Orleans know its music, or what? Do On Point listeners know their culture, or what? Sean, you're fantastic. We've got that chromatic descending. You're beyond me, but I love your analysis. May the best band win, I guess. Thanks to everybody for being with us this week. Ken Rudin with Ken Rudin's Political Junkie Podcast. Thank you so much, Ken. Brian Monroe with CNN. Jack Beatty, thanks to all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.